This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge and pay our respect to elders past and present.
330 miles across shifting sandhills, stony plains, and the flat, dry beds of ancient streams. A lane through the burning centre of Australia. The Birdsville Track.
Australia, the 1950s. Every 2 weeks, a single truck travels the remote Birdsville Track, linking South Australia and Queensland. At more than 500 kilometres long, it's a difficult journey, characterised by searing heat, dusty terrain and limited human contact.
A bare, dry rut, disappearing into the mirage, over the edge of the world.
The Back of Beyond is a landmark documentary charting one of these expeditions. It was produced by the Shell Film Unit in 1954 as a way of associating the company with quintessential Australian-ness.
It echoes now to a man and his truck, a carrier called Cruz.
Across 60 minutes, we follow mailman Tom Cruz. Yes, I know. As he makes his way along the track. There, he interacts with a cast of compelling characters, like Bija, the Afghan Camellia, and Joe the Rainmaker, who each have their own way of existing in these harsh, desolate places.
Okay, Tom.
How you doing?
Okay.
Our passenger's still with us.
Can't shake that bloke off. He's like a fleeing a kangaroo.
In this episode of Seeing Green, we explore how the Back of Beyond represents the environment as an expression of national identity, touching on themes of water scarcity, extreme weather, cultural belonging and white settler histories. And to do this, I'm joined by two experts from different fields. First up, Associate Professor Ruth Morgan, who's an environmental historian and director of the Centre for Environmental History at the Australian National University. Ruth has published extensively on topics like water and climate history, to name a few. She's also Vice President of the International Consortium of Environmental History Organisations and Treasurer of the International Water History Association. And all that makes her very well qualified to be on Seeing Green. Ruth, thanks for being on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Dylan.
And so I've given a bit of a snapshot of your research background, but tell us a bit more about the kind of work that you do.
Well, I suppose it's always about how people relate to place over time. And coming from the West Coast, coming from Perth, I've been very conscious of how, I suppose, place can shape identity and how environments really figure in the ways that people relate to their world. So I'm always interested, I guess, in our understandings of climate and how those have changed over time, and very much seeing the ways that water is understood and managed as being an expression of relationships to climate. So with those sorts of influences in mind, I've explored all kinds of things in the Australian context, but increasingly trying to show connections with other parts of the world where Australia shares, I suppose, similar challenges around aridity and scarcity, real or imagined.
Yeah, and I'm interested in where that work has taken you. I mean, have you visited the area around the Birdsville Track?
Actually, I've written on sort of surrounding areas, and it's been something that I've really wanted to do. I've wanted to go on one of these great camel tours through the area, which I think just would be such an incredible way to experience the region. But alas, no, I've driven across the Nullarbor a couple of times, and that's probably the closest I've got.
Well, there's plenty of time. And we're also joined by today's film expert and the co-executive producer of this podcast, Associate Professor Belinda Smale from Monash University. Hey, Belinda, great to have you back behind the microphone for Seeing Green.
Yes, thanks, Dylan. Great to be here.
And so far in this podcast, we've looked at fictional film. This is the first documentary we're exploring. Why did you want to cover The Back of Beyond?
Yes, we have only been looking at fiction films, but my particular interest is documentary. And there have been so many documentaries produced in Australia that have relevance to environmental concerns. But The Back of Beyond really stands out because not only does it present these really interesting and complex representations of the Australian outback, but it is the most celebrated film of Australia's post-war era. Whether fiction or documentary, it's just such an iconic and noteworthy film for a range of reasons that we're going to explore. But it's the film to talk about in the 40s, 50s and 60s, I would say.
Yeah. And so give us some context in terms of how this documentary came about.
Yes, so there's a really interesting background to this film, because one thing that's often cited in relation to the film, but only really mentioned in passing, is the fact that it's produced by Shell Oil. So Shell Oil had a film unit in Australia that was set up in 1948, Shell Film Unit Australia. This was modelled on another unit that was set up in London, the first that Shell set up. And like a number of corporations around the middle of the 20th century, they were really interested in documentary as a kind of public relations vehicle. And this took many, many different forms. In relation to Shell, there was a perceived value in producing films that weren't actually explicitly about oil, selling oil, producing oil, or visualizing it in any way. So this is a really interesting history for people who are, you know, interested in filmmaking and the environment, because, yeah, they saw that there was great value in producing what in corporate terms would be called a prestige documentary and creating this kind of associative ideology that would rub off on corporate status. So these really lush, well-made films, if we look at Back of Beyond, it doesn't have any mention of Shell apart from the brand at the end. But as we will hopefully unpack a little bit today, there's a whole lot of kind of implicit ideological markers that associate with Shell's mission in Australia.
In the Back of Beyond, the environment is so important. It's shown as a powerful force that crucially shapes the lives and the national sense of self. Do oil companies regularly make films that respect the environment or even environmental documentaries?
Well, no, it's not common, but I think we see an interesting period in the 1960s, after the time when Shell was really prominent in Australia, where oil companies really, their public relations departments were huge. And I think this is something we can learn from looking at a film like The Back of Beyond. The way that oil companies produced what we think of as petrocinema, it's a convenient way of talking about this kind of filmmaking, points to the amount of money that they pumped into their public relations agenda. So it was really important to shape how society viewed them so that they could continue to do their work across the globe. Shell had film units in Egypt, Venezuela, the Philippines, all kinds of places to kind of continue this good citizen profile that they wanted to promote. But then we have this interesting kind of development in the 1960s when there was more and more discussion of pollution and environmental degradation. And we have companies like BP and Shell, their film arms or units making films that actually highlighted these problems. And they kind of did this in an attempt to appropriate and reorient the narrative in a ways that kind of they believed would create faith in the unstoppable benefit of technology and industrial progress and what the oil companies were doing. But of course, as environmental activism, environmental movements progressed, this started to feel a little bit out of sync. So in the archive, we can see these really interesting early examples of environmental film made by oil companies before filmmakers were really getting on board with this, which I think is a really fascinating phenomenon and tells us about the oil archive, but also about how fossil fuel companies perceived their role and their kind of confidence in what they were doing.
And Ruth, I'm really interested in how you relate to this film as an environmental historian. Having watched it, what really stands out to you in terms of the way that it represents the environment and our relationship with it?
Gosh, a big question there, Dylan. I must confess, I hadn't seen the film before. It's one that I'd heard about, and I vaguely knew that Shell and similar companies had produced these sorts of documentaries before, but I hadn't sat down to watch it before. And I suppose watching it and just listening to Belinda describe a bit of background about Shell's efforts here, it made me appreciate how, as much as we live in a very sort of petroleum-saturated fossil fuel society today, that this was not inevitable. People had to learn and become familiar with petroleum products in this period. And so it's really interesting to sort of go back to the time when there might have been other ways. And of course, there had been other ways to get around this very remote, or at least remote from the coast. I think that's important to keep in mind, not remote for the people living there, that this was a new technology, a new means of getting around, which had to be, I suppose, made familiar, and documentary was going to be one of those ways of doing that. So I was just struck with, well, so much of the film. It was not what I expected. There wasn't the kind of cliche that I expected. And I suppose that speaks perhaps to the sophistication of the documentary makers. The kind of brutality, beauty and brutality that is being depicted here was really quite moving in terms of the conditions in which people are living and working, whether they're Indigenous or non-Indigenous, I think. It is not an easy life for anyone or anything. It's a really kind of marginal existence that has a beauty to it because it's stark and sterile, and the soundtrack and the depiction of that is really quite moving.
Central Australia, a vast flat wilderness, as large as Europe and 1,000 miles from anywhere.
But it's also just the hostility of that environment to any life is quite amazing. And yet then we have this amazing outbreak of a flood, and how that is both a challenge as well as an opportunity. And you can almost see Tom Cruise, the protagonist, our hero.
With a K.
If you like, yes, Tom Cruise with a K, important to note. That they are almost giddy with excitement with this water coming into their arid landscape, even though it's obviously a massive challenge for them to cross this flooded river. So I suppose that's just a few things that caught my eye.
Then suddenly, down from the north, it comes in flood. Once or twice in a lifetime, rolling out over the plains 40 miles wide, an inland sea.
To come back, I suppose, to the overall look and feel of the film, both in terms of how it's shot and the poetics of the landscape that's depicted and in the scripted narration itself. Belinda, I wonder if you could describe for us how the film actually feels once you inhabit the atmosphere of it, and how reflective this was of documentary film at the time it was made.
Well, I would say that it's an unusual film for the time, in that, you know, there was a lot of film being made at the time that kind of bought into this post-war ethos around nation building. You know, there was a lot of big infrastructure projects happening. There was a kind of optimism and celebration of the nation that filmmakers and, you know, the Commonwealth Film Unit and Australian National Film Board before it were engaged in kind of supporting these narratives, and nature was seen as a resource for generating wealth, really. The Back of Beyond is quite unusual because, as Ruth says, it's really about exploring the hostility of the environment, this poetic voiceover that we hear throughout the film that frames the film in quite a different way, a complex way. It's about people adapting to a harsh environment.
Corrugated iron towns shimmering in the corrugated air. The retreat of men and women from the immensity of sand. White men, black men, Afghan.
And the way the film is framed and shot also supports this idea. We feel the environment as much as seeing it. We're asked to when we watch the film. The dust storms are a real tactile aspect of this. We can feel Tom Cruise as he's in his truck with dust and grime, the wind. We also see these shots looking at someone from behind with flies all over their back, which is kind of although it's a carefully put together film, the editing is extremely sophisticated, the shots are very well composed, so it wasn't an accident that the kind of heat is conveyed in the image. But we have in the Back of Beyond, the camera and the editing are constantly gesturing, I think, to what is beyond the frame. So we get a sense that we're in a much vaster country than just a shot focused on the truck. There's this iconic ramshackle truck that takes us through the whole film. And we see shots, the camera suspended on the truck, looking out to the horizon. We see the truck moving across the horizon. There's constant references to, you know, this bigger space and structures, houses located in these vast landscapes, which is reinforced by this voiceover. And I think early in the film, Marie is described as a wilted flower of a town or something similar, just saying that civilization is here, but it's really compromised in many ways by this environment.
Yeah. I found myself scribbling down, you know, an inordinate amount of quotes from the film, because the poetry is quite beautiful and stark, and it's so arresting as you're watching these incredibly dramatic scenes. And there are a few references to flowers in this film. There's one point where the narrator says,
"Man makes his mark across a fierce country that has no flowers but the whitening bones of long dead cattle. Life, if it hopes to breathe, must crawl in the shade of a stone. All tastes like dust in the mouth. All strikes like iron in the mind."
And it kind of reinforced to me that the sense that there's very much a colonial narrative here about the struggle of man, in inverted commas, to have mastery over nature, to construct these, you know, allotment gardens in these incredibly difficult conditions. Ruth, I'm interested in how or to what extent you see this as reflecting some of those sort of tropes around colonial narratives and the civilizing mission, given that you said earlier that it sort of in some ways doesn't engage in some cliches that we might expect it to.
There is this long-held idea that cultivation of the soil is really what cements your occupation and ownership of a country, in inverted commas, or a territory. And so there's, I suppose, a tenuous grip here of settler colonialism in this landscape. Clearly, we see that uneasiness for the white people who live in this area. Their townships are very sparse. They're very rudimentary compared to perhaps what urban Australians would have been familiar with. They're very remote. And I think that we can't stress that enough. And I think those incredible shots that Belinda was talking about just really emphasize loneliness and remoteness. Even though they're trying to make community, they're trying to make home, they're trying to make a place here, it's always very marginal in every sense of the word. And the closest hold they have over this is really through this stock route, which is the Birdsville track, and of bringing cattle down to the railhead at Port Augusta. This is really the only settler occupation that is working, because they can't cultivate crops. They can't cultivate even a garden. And of course, even religion, even bringing in Christian faith here is challenging, as we have that really moving passage where the church, the mission, the German mission has been sort of abandoned basically. And there's a real lament, I suppose, for that passing.
"This was our store, our school, and our church. This was our promised land."
And yet, despite all that marginality and almost the desperate condition that people are living in, there's a kind of a happy optimism, in a way, that perhaps with the addition of petroleum and roads and machinery and more technology, that we can hold on, we can conquer this. And with, you know, shortwave radio, with modern medicine, the future could be better. It won't always be so difficult.
"Ayrton Excess at dinner calling Cowrie. Hello, Cowrie. Wonder how you're about this morning, Dora. I'll have a listen for you. Over."
Yeah, and Tom Cruise himself is such a sort of happy-go-lucky kind of figure, isn't he? In one scene, he's dancing around with like a mannequin or something like that, and he's very much a jovial character as he makes his way along the track and meets all these intriguing characters. In terms of, I suppose, generally, the way in which colonial narratives have impacted the way in which we relate to the environment, how do you reflect on that in the context of this film and what it's doing about, I suppose, white settler colonialism and the uneasiness, I guess, with establishing these civilizations in places where, you know, you can read into it, you know, white man potentially isn't supposed to be?
Yeah, it's quite stark, I think, the depiction there of what civilization, in inverted commas, looks like in this context, where you have attempts to set up nuclear families, but it's a very difficult place for that to survive, because women and their children appear to be incredibly vulnerable, not only because their menfolk are often away for long periods of time, whether it's Tom Cruise and his team taking goods up the stock route, or whether they're mustering cattle or doing whatever labour they have to do. So these women are left alone for incredibly long periods of time, where they're vulnerable to climate, to snake bites potentially, to any number of problems, and their own ill health. And they're trying to raise children in this really challenging environment.
Who
And I don't think this is unique to this particular landscape. I think an earlier generation of literature would have seen this more in the bush rather than the desert. But it's, again, this tenuous hold of civilization in these places. And yet the family is critical to this. Although we don't see much of Tom Cruise's background, you see these constant gestures to domesticity and family life, even in that makeshift camp next to the flooded river where he's dancing with the mannequin that you mentioned. That's set up like a living room almost, and they're enacting kind of family life, although they're three men together. So it's quite interesting to see that in this really difficult landscape.
Yeah. How would you respond to that, Belinda?
As Ruth was talking, I was just thinking about the rationale for the film. As Ruth was saying, the presentation of family life, the role of women there. And of course, it's a scripted documentary, not an observational documentary where a filmmaker would go out and just happen to capture people on the road. But these were all set up, you know, even to the extent of setting up reenactments of particular activities and incidents on the postal run. And we know that the brief to John Heyer from the London, you know, Shell organisation was to make a film that was going to tell Australia that we are with you. So Shell is with you, to show the essence of Australian life. What Shell wanted to do was not be seen as a corporation that was just imposing its products on Australia, but that it was domesticated, it was seen as a good citizen, it recognised the issues of people in their lives. So, you know, this all kind of comes through in a narrative, poetic form in the film. But of course, there are other kind of creative things that Heyer did that make it more than that even. And the environment and the experience and the materiality of the environment he decided was really integral there. And just, I think there's really an interesting point that kind of gets to what a sophisticated filmmaker he was. He's talked about how he wanted to not just show the environment as a background, but show it as an active force in people's life. For a filmmaker, that was, at that time, really quite amazing, yeah.
While there is a strong, you know, we've talked about a white settler kind of narrative that flows through this film, it's not like they only show white Europeans in the film at all. I mean, there are a number of you know, First Nations people we meet along the way, and also Bija, the Afghan cameleer, who I think is called, along with Tom Cruise, a sort of battler of this region, who's really, you know, lived through some harsh conditions and found a way to survive there. And in one of the most arresting films of the film for me was when Bija prays to Allah on a prayer rug set amid this, again, very dramatic, sandy, stony terrain. What do you make of this conceptualization, I suppose, or representation of multiculturalism in Australia and belonging amid particular environments at a time when, of course, the White Australia policy was still in place?
Yes, it's really interesting, and I suppose this goes back to my comment about the kind of tropes or what I expected to see and then what I did see. And I was very taken moved by the way in which they depicted, I suppose, faith in this context. And I suspect that's appeal to the ways in which in Abrahamic faiths the desert is sort of a place of self-discovery and reflection and finding God or Allah in this case. And we even have a indigenous rainmaker depicted as well. And there's quite an incredible depiction there of different ways of coping, I suppose, with this hostile environment. And it's probably a little anachronistic to say multiculturalism in this context. We know that Beja Dervish has arrived in Australia prior to the introduction of the White Australia policy, as you might have imagined, and like so many others who have found their way through the circuits of empire and found a way to flourish in the Australian colonies, and then he goes to make his life as a camel driver. And then at the same time, we have an interesting depiction of local Indigenous peoples who are in some ways helpers in the colonial project, of helping Tom Cruise, helping the pastoralists, working on these stations. We have Indigenous children, we have Indigenous women interacting with nurses, I think, along the way. And so this kind of interesting coexistence. It looks very benign and it looks like this is a very sort of gentle civilizing mission. But you do have questions, I feel, of how we've arrived at this coexistence, I think, and the kinds of transformations and violent processes to get to this point. Although we do know that particularly for South Asian and Indigenous peoples working through this inland area, there was also coexistence, not always peaceful, but also of intermarriage, of other kinds of relationships that have flourished along these routes, because South Asians were taking camels and were the precursors, I suppose, to rail and road travel, because their camels were able to navigate this area and haul enormously, you know, huge loads of goods. And a lot of those routes, of course, were negotiated with Indigenous peoples, often not willingly, but by this point in time, you're not getting much of an insight into that. So I think we're being shown a particular kind of scene, potentially where certain old ways, whether they're Indigenous, whether they're South Asian, Muslim, they're old ways that are passing on. And I think it's showing us rather politely that we are moving into a new future, which is mostly European.
And I'm really keen to draw upon your expertise around water, Ruth. There's a scene in the film where there's a shot of an aquifer spouting water from below the earth, and we hear that this is a man-made oasis.
A man-made oasis where green reeds grow in steam and thirsty cattle can drink.
And again, see how this is tied to man, again in inverted commas, man's ability to survive in the outback, or challenge to survive in the outback, which of course water plays a crucial role in that. I wonder if you can reflect on the role of water in the film, but also the broader role that water has played in Australia's interior and how we might associate that with our sense of belonging or challenge to belong in the outback.
I think it's really stark in this film, the way in which we have the extreme absence of water, extreme scarcity, these shots of just sand, stone on the Gibber Plains, the shots of desiccated skeletons of the stock that didn't make it.
Year after year, only mud and sand, and the parched remains of mobs of cattle that once came looking for water.
So extreme aridity, and then we have a flood. And we have these occasional oases, whether they're man-made or not. It's interesting for a film that I suppose in some ways is about the settler colonial project, if you like, but also showing the real materiality of that environment and its effects on what humans in this environment can actually do. Of course, with the stock route, the whole Birdsville track, it can only exist because that water is there. They can have to go this way because that's where the water is. And they only know where that water is because a generation or two earlier, explorers with Indigenous guides, again, not entirely voluntary, showed them where that water was. And so that they could establish waypoints to get through this incredibly arid environment, because Europeans and the British explorers didn't really know where to find water in this environment, because it wasn't just sitting out in the open, it's deep in the ground, as you mentioned. It's in, basically, this is the Great Artesian Basin that they're moving across. And so that's not exactly making itself very evident visually to people coming through that aren't familiar. So a lot of these wells started as native wells, as they were called. So this is Indigenous people knew where the water was and how to get it, because it wasn't always spouting out. It sometimes had to be dug for and climbed down into these wells. And so it's with the Europeans that are coming through that are making these more permanent and more accessible. And so it becomes this debate at the turn of the 20th century, really trying to work out, well, are these water supplies infinite and can we just keep using them extravagantly, letting them flow? And we saw images of that with uncapped wells just flowing, which looks luxurious and bountiful, But there was another camp who were concerned that actually this is a finite resource, or certainly isn't replenishing as quickly as we might hope it would be. So there's sort of this early water conservation movement around how to actually protect this reserve, because without that water, the whole opening up of this inland for cattle grazing mostly is just not going to happen. Whoever is living in that environment is incredibly conscious of it, whether they're Indigenous or non-Indigenous. They know that without that access, they're a goner. So I think this is one of those parts of Australia and one of these particular routes that are really defining, because they're actually allowing these parts of Australia that otherwise would be incredibly inaccessible to be exploited for the colonial economy, really.
Ruth, do you think this documentary offers us anything that's particularly helpful or productive in thinking through some of the contemporary, you know, really significant concerns we have around climate change, extreme weather, you know, native species protection, all these kinds of issues that are very much front of mind for so many of us at the moment? Does this film do anything in terms of enabling us to think more critically or productively about those very large issues?
Ooh. Big question, juicy. If we're talking about these bigger issues, it reminds us, I guess, of the agency of nature. And as much as climate change challenges are entirely human caused, and as much as we have a biodiversity crisis that, again, is also human caused, I think it is reminding us that there is a certain majesty of nature, with all its baggage, that we should be mindful of, because of course, as much as humans have changed the environment, a huge part of that is contingent. We don't know the full effects of what we are doing to the environment, because it has all sorts of mechanisms that we're not entirely across. So there's a element of surprise there. You know, that was a comment a climate scientist made in the 1980s, the surprises in the greenhouse, because we don't know what chains of reaction we're setting off. And just like the flood that Tom Cruise encounters, it's unexpected to some degree, even though this area does flood from time to time. It's a boom-bust climate. When exactly that's going to happen, we need to be prepared for those sorts of contingencies, because they are going to intensify as we continue to pump out fossil fuels.
8XJ, 8XJ, Tom is arriving. Tom is arriving. 8XJ calling Clifton Hills. Tom is arriving.
Leaping off from there, Belinda, both in terms of, I suppose, how the Back of Beyond represents this challenging relationship we have with the environment and weather in particular, how do you feel documentary film today is representing some of these issues, and I suppose the ability for us to change or alter our relationship with, whether it's fossil fuels or the way that we attempt to use the environment for sustenance? Is documentary film, broadly speaking, successfully doing that for us today, given the very real and present danger of climate change that we're much more aware of now than we were in the 1950s?
I think documentary has taken an extremely important role in all kinds of ways. So we have a lot of filmmakers who are concerned about the environment, who are developing new ways of speaking to people about this. And, you know, An Inconvenient Truth was a landmark documentary that had an impact that, you know, that was unprecedented. So I think we can think of the landscape as being pre and post An Inconvenient Truth. I will just say that Australia has been very behind in this realm. So we've seen the kind of international development of a broad category we might think of as the environmental documentary. And we have seen much greater interest from non-government organisations, so from philanthropic organisations, to invest in filmmakers and documentaries, because they see them as these kind of mechanisms that can travel within groups, that can really bring information and do so in really engaging ways. It's taken a long time for Australia to really get on board, not because of the fault of the filmmakers, but we haven't had, you know, public broadcasters or funding organisations more broadly interested in environmental issues in the way they might have been interested in other issues until about 2015, where we saw kinds of initiatives that were imported into Australia to produce greater connections between philanthropists of all kinds and documentary filmmakers. So it was up to the private sector to really get on board with producing what we might think of as environmental documentary in Australia. And then we get films like 2040 that were funded in this way. And slowly we're getting Screen Australia and other groups to add funding. But that's been a really interesting and important development in the documentary sector in Australia.
Well, it's been such a wonderful opportunity for me to engage with this film, and so grateful to you both for providing your insights on this episode of Seeing Green. Belinda and Ruth, really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dylan. Thanks, Belinda.
Seeing Green is made at Swinburne University of Technology and Monash University and is supported by an Australian Research Council Discovery Grant. Our executive producers are Professor Therese Davis and Associate Professor Belinda Smale. Production and mixing by Britta Jorgensen. Music by Ash Sterling and hosted by me, Dylan Bird. Follow, rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. On the next episode of Seeing Green, we set sail for the Pacific Ocean.
I couldn't help but thinking, oh, it's Mad Max at Sea.
I was fascinated and, to be frank, perturbed by the place-less character of Seascape in most of this film.